Your rhyme sayers, who lead you like a beacon of light out of the chaos, cracking down overzealous players who stay up, when the winners of the game walking well prepared, climbing the stairways to heaven while you're scared of the people living under, round heard the sound of the clap made you wonder, if it was a gun, the cloud or some thunder, all of that was out my window when I was younger, now I'm much older.
Alright, welcome to another 3NR podcast. Scott Phillips along with
Bill Batterman and
Roy Lefkowitz.
Thank you all for joining us once again. The first thing that we want to talk about or announce is that we would like to once again call on our readers, our listeners to help us to develop a logo for the 3NR. This is something that we did just a month or so into the site, and we got a few responses, none of which ended up being something that we thought that would work out, but essentially we would like someone with some artistic ability, some Photoshop ability to develop a logo for the 3NR, and that logo could be used on bumper stickers, on t-shirts, and on the site itself. We would also be interested in designs for bumper stickers or t-shirts or both, or any other kind of promotional material that you think might be cool. If you have an idea for a logo, I guess we'll put up a new post with this information, but you should send it to the three of us. Preferably, you know, just attach an image or whatever, or send us a link to a Mediafire or to another download site. But kind of go crazy, come up with a logo. A basic 3NR logo would be great, as well as maybe, you know, funny or more complicated designs for a t-shirt or a bumper sticker. Roy, any advice for people who are thinking about making a logo? I know we rejected a bunch of logos because they were terrible, but what are you looking for?
Some level of appropriateness. The beer can logo, I think, that we got, or that used all the letters from different beers, that probably won't make it onto the site or as our logo, but just something that looks cool and that, you know, not only would look cool on our website, but that we could use, you know, in other projects that we're considering developing. And since neither of us are the most creative people out there, any help from you all would be great.
And Scott, do you still want flames on our logo?
Yeah, clearly we need a cool logo to make up for the just boringness of our WordPress template. But I would say I didn't think the designs that got sent to us before were quote-unquote terrible. I don't want to discourage anyone from sending in designs because they think we're going to rip them apart. The problem I thought was just that you know, they were just kind of like a font on a background. And so hopefully, you know, maybe some people have some MS Paint skills or something. Maybe make it a little bit more intricate and artsy.
Yeah, for sure. The logos that I thought were terrible were mostly the ones that my own students made when I asked them to make logos. They were indeed terrible.
Also, if you have a big feeling on whether or not we should change our 3NR background template, Scott's really wanted it to change for a long time now. So if we hear from you all that we want to change it, maybe we could possibly do something about that, right, Bo?
Yeah, for sure. If somebody wants to develop a WordPress template for us, we would be happy to use it. Or if there is an open source template that you like, if you want to recommend it, send it to the three of us, and we can decide whether we want to change. But definitely it would be awesome if somebody with a lot of graphic design skills wanted to do a logo and a design that goes along with it. I know a lot of you listening probably have some web design skills, and if you want to, you know, something to add to your portfolio or to do as part of a class or something like that, we would be happy to you know, receive the benefit of your expertise. So get in touch with us. I'll post another message about this, just reminding people, or for those of you who don't listen to the podcast.
Yeah, I think that's probably enough mooching off the listeners.
That's probably
good. It's getting a little excessive. If any of your parents know our doctor, Roy's foot needs some looking at, I could use a new house. So any of those skills would also be useful moving right along.
So, Roy, you were at the University of Michigan tournament this week, this past weekend, and you had a couple things you want to talk about, so why don't you dive in, and then we will share our thoughts.
All right, yeah. Well, I guess the MPJ system wasn't working too well at the University of Michigan tournament. I ended up judging a bunch of debates, I think maybe five or six even.
That's a new debates. Record.
That's definitely a new record. And only, you know, a couple, three or so elims, so, you know, I made an elim.
That's a semester's worth.
Big amount of debates, but one thing that I noticed in these debates and one thing that kind of impacted the decisions in a lot of these debates was just the negative making giant sloppiness mistakes. In one debate, the negative team forgot to kick out of a dis-ed in the block, and the affirmative straight turned the dis-ed in the 1AR and gave themselves some nice new impacts to hedge against the negative's turns. In another debate, the 2NR dropped conditionality, and it happened to even be on the sheet of paper that he was going for, which was even more problematic. And in a third debate, another issue where the dis-ed wasn't kicked out of properly or at all by the negative, and the affirmative was able to use that to get themselves some wins. And it was kind of just mind-boggling because it's not that difficult, you know, to kick out of a sheet of paper, but it seems as if negatives aren't, you know, looking at the sheets of paper correctly or aren't, you know, just going for what they want to go for without doing the appropriate who's going to kick out of this type of discussion between them and their partners. And, you know, the easiest way to botch some negative wins is to let the AF, you know, get away with a conceded conditionality debate or, you know, some straight turn stuff. So I didn't understand why, and I just don't understand how a negative can go about not kicking positions and not recognizing their sheets of paper that need to be addressed with, you know, before they go into the rest of their strategy. And it kind of makes me wonder if the negatives are just too closed-minded and they just get ready for what they're going to go for and they don't think that the rest of the debate kind of matters anymore. So that was my big rant, you know, three neg losses because of giant mistakes like that, and, you know, it cost some teams some Tournament of Champions bids and in the process. So it was kind of significant mistake.
Did the AF figure it out right away in all these?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the doubles and the octos, the affirmative was on top of what was going on there for sure and definitely capitalized on the mistakes that were made. So at least the AFs get points for catching on to mistakes that were made. But
well, Scott, you got anything to add? I got a couple things, but you can go ahead.
I mean, I don't know. I guess Roy has staked out a pretty uncontroversial position, like don't drop positionality bad. I don't really know. I'm trying to think of how I could disagree with him, but I got nothing.
Well, I guess thinking about this from kind of a, you know, diagnosing what the issue is, kind of two things, I guess. Number one is, I think, and this is interesting because I think this is something I've been thinking about too as I judge debates, especially lower level debates, is I think that a lot of debaters don't know what they should be doing during prep time. I think they don't know necessarily what they should be doing, when they should be taking prep time, kind of what their job is during the prep time. I think the comment about closed-mindedness is very appropriate, I think. So, for example, if the 2NC knows that they're going for, you know, the politics DA in the case, I think they get very focused on reviewing the 2AC, writing down their answers next to it, and then getting up to give that speech without thinking about the broader strategic interactions. And I think that that's partially a product of not practicing prep time. So when we do practices, when we encourage kids to do practice speeches or whatever, the prep time component is usually not something that we talk about or not something that we walk students through. And so it's kind of, I think, a coaching shortcoming, and something that I would like to maybe improve the way that I coach is to kind of walk kids through mentally what they should be thinking about as they are listening to, especially when they're negative, when they're listening to the 2AC, kind of how do you decide what to go for, when should you audible from the pre-round strategy that you have come up with, what each partner should be doing, and that's the second thing, and then, you know, get Ryan Scott's thoughts, but the biggest thing, the first thing I thought of when Roy was describing these is I was thinking, what was the one end doing? Because that's a situation where debate is a two-person activity. The negative team is two people. If the 2N is making a mistake, the 1N needs to be aware of that mistake and needs to participate and prompt them and tell them, you know, you forgot conditionality, or, you know, the 1N needs to be aware that the 2N didn't kick out of the DA. So they need to talk to each other, and the 1N needs to be cognizant of that. It's kind of the same thing I've seen 2ACs. I saw a couple 2ACs this year that have dropped a position. And it's usually just a, you know, an innocent mistake where they left the sheet of paper, they turned over two flows instead of one. But the 1A didn't prompt them, didn't say, you know, you forgot this argument or whatever. So partners need to take responsibility for that, because a lot of times it's kind of an innocent mistake or a mistake that, is sort of a physical mistake where it's, you know, they switched the flow or they, you know, forgot to bring something up. And so the other partner needs to, do that. But I think sort of practicing preparation is important, and making sure that partners are working together and conscious of what's going on is important. And I think those are the two ways that people can prevent errors like this from occurring. Because obviously these are relatively good teams if they're in the elimination rounds of Michigan. I think that's kind of proof that this is a generalized problem. And it's very noticeable in lower level debates, but it's even noticeable in some of these better debates. So what do you guys think about that?
I definitely think it's like 60% the person who messed up's fault, and then 40% the partner. So in the instance of conditionality, it's definitely like a 60% the 2N should have realized that they weren't answering conditionality, 40% that, you know, the 1NR should realize that type thing. You know, if you're just asleep at the wheel when you're the 1NR, you know, your job is really, while the 2NR is giving their speech, to kind of flow along and make sure that, you know, everything goes, you know, goes about smoothly. If you aren't paying attention to that, then, you know, you're kind of doing yourself a disservice. The kicking out of the dis-ed thing is definitely, they should coordinate that, but I could see that part being a little bit more the 2N's fault, because if the 1NR is theoretically prepping while the 2NC is going, they might not be listening to exactly what's at the top of the speech. But definitely, you know, any 2NR mistake or any 2NR concession is, you know, 60% 2N fault, 40% 1N fault for not paying attention to what their partner was doing. Phillips, anything? No.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't know. I guess it is kind of the 1N's fault, but, I mean, conditionality is on the same page. Like, you probably shouldn't need another person to check you on that. But I mean, let me just ask you a question, Roy. These teams who were dropping things, were they flowing on paper or the computer?
The conditionality was, computer.
Hmm. Because if they were flowing in debate synergy, the second you type conditionality, it highlights the cell for you, to flag it so that you don't drop it. So they should get a better flow template, I think.
Maybe they should. In another instance where a team was paperless but flowing on paper, there was a mistake made. But
I guess we know the root of that.
Yeah. The conditionality, well, I definitely saw some paperless faux pas, and I'm not going to name names to be mean, but they listen to the podcast and they know they screwed the pooch pretty bad with the paperless. But no, I think that it, you know, it was one paperless, one paper, but I don't think it was, it was just mental lapses, you know, like, people not paying attention to what's going on and cost them two debates.
Well, I guess one of the other things we're going to talk about is the article that you wrote about block strategy, but kind of as a segue to that, what do you guys think about the percentage of the block strategy that should be determined before the debate? Or I guess a better way to say it is, you know, before the debate, you decide what the 1NC is, you decide what the most likely 2NC, 1NR split will be. How often do you think that debaters should deviate from that pre-planned strategy? Kind of how flexible should debaters be? Should negative debaters be about altering the strategy that they have decided on before the debate? And what kinds of things would be good justifications for that kind of deviation? I mean, obviously, if the 2AC drops something, or if the 2AC, you know, double turns themselves or something, those are situations where you need to change. But assuming that the 2AC is good or strong, what should the 2N especially be thinking about as he or she is listening to the 2AC to decide, you know, we're going to stick with the plan that we had before the debate, or we're going to jump ship and make an alteration? As the captain of the negative ship, what should the 2N be thinking about? What should factor into their decision? And how often do you think an average 2N in high school should deviate from their pre-round strategy?
You want to go first, Scott, or you want me to go first?
Yeah, are you talking about for the block or for the 2NR?
Well, let's start with the block, and then I also have a sort of a related question for the 2NR. But let's think about it first for developing the block as you're listening to the 2AC.
Well, I think ideally if they've done the 1NC well, choosing for the block, it should be basically choosing from a couple of options to pick two independent strategies that can be extended in the block. So it could be, you know, a K and like a counterplan with an internal net benefit like Lopez or something. Or it could be like politics, a counterplan and case, such that you can go for politics and the counterplan or politics and the case. But I basically think that the block should always have two options in it. So in picking which one of those things should go where, I think a couple of factors you should consider is, one, like what level of prep is required for it. So if changing what you're going for is going to take a lot of your 2NC prep time, I think that can be hurtful, because I think it's better to really well execute a strategy that the AF did okay on than it is to poorly execute a strategy that the AF kind of screwed up in the 2AC. So I think that's one factor that you should consider. Second, one thing that Roy highlighted in his article was like certain arguments do better in the 1NR than they do in other speeches. So things that you don't want to be cross-exed on, like critiques, what does the alternative do? You know, it's never a good cross-ex for the negative when those kind of questions get brought up. Or like politics, which often has sketchy internal link evidence. So putting those kind of things in the 1NR can be helpful. So if you're trying to figure out what strategies to go for, and you're trying to make a choice that would force you to take some of those issues in the 2NC instead of the 1NR, that could be a factor to kind of change your outlook. The other thing, I think I disagree with one of the people who commented on Roy's article about like theory. I think the more things that you have that are totally blocked out that you can do in the 2NC and use as little prep time as possible is a good idea. So if you have like a lot of blocks for a counterplan that's maybe not great, but the AF, you know, just mainly made theory objections and you have that pretty well set to go, I think that's a good factor to choose to go for that in the 2NC, because then you save your prep time for later, and it's also, you know, you've got blocks, so your speech is going to be better than if you kind of give it off the top of your head. I think the factors that people base their decisions on too often are predetermined before the round, so they totally ignore what the AF did. Or they kind of choose to go for arguments that are terrible because the AF spent very little time on them, when in reality the very little time that the AF spent is more than sufficient to defeat them. So I think a lot of times you'll see a 2NR on like the military budget trade-off DA that the 2NC extended because the AF didn't say very much on it, when in reality, you know, you don't need to say a whole lot to that dis-ed.
For me, the biggest issue is kind of the difference between a debater who gets it and doesn't get it is the one who can sort of adapt to the strategy based off the 2AC. And, you know, I found myself when I was working, you know, working with like the younger kids, where I'll sort of map out what the ideal 2NC strategy is, or pre-round, and then sort of list lower level 2NC strats based off what happens. But I think that, you know, you sort of need to have a gut instinct of, you know, if before the debate round you and your coach were talking, or you and your partner were talking, and you're like, we're going to go for states and politics, and then the 2NC, you know, the 2AC makes, you know, 16 answers on politics, it might be time to reevaluate the politics option. So I think that the thing that I like doing with my lower teams is I make sure that they, and even with the top teams, is that I think that they should take prep time after the 2AC to have a quick discussion about, did the 2AC do anything to change what our original game plan was? You know, did they read an add-on we want to impact turn? You know, did they make so many answers on politics that it's not worth going for? Did they, you know, undercover T, so maybe T's now become an option? And I think that, you know, you sort of need to know as a 2N, can I win on this option now? And Scott's definitely right. Like, some people will make three answers to a military trade-off DA and they'll be extended in the block, but, you know, if the F doesn't link to the military trade-off DA and that's one of their three answers, it's usually good enough. So, you know, don't just, it's not just the quantity of arguments on the flow, it's sort of like the quality of the argument that the F makes and whether or not you think that your strategy is able to defeat it. And I think that, you know, two ends need to grow into figuring out how, you know, what is now, what is an acceptable number of 2EC arguments, what is not acceptable, and then it's sort of like trial by fire, because when we watch, like, camp debates with the sophomores in them, and Bill, you work with the sophomores explicitly, like, they'll stick to what their pre-round strategy was regardless of what the 2AC does. You know, it just won't change if even if the 2AC made one or two answers on another sheet of paper, because before the debate, they decided they were going for that. So, you know, you've got to be willing to be flexible, and you just have to be confident that, you know, you'll eventually be making the right decisions. So.
Yeah, I think that I've seen that, I think twice already this season where the 2AC has dropped an argument and then the negative has not gone for it. So once it was a really bad dissad, some like poverty good dissad, and the other time it was, I forget what it was. It was some, I think it was a theory argument or a procedural of some sort, like an enforcement specification argument or something. And the thing that I like to teach is that the arguments that you put in the 1NC all should have to pass the can I go for them test. I think too many times when people are constructing their 1NC strategy, they have two or three arguments that they know they think they can go for that they're ready to debate. And then their preparation before the round or before the 1NC consists of figuring out what else they can throw into the speech to fill it up and to make the 2AC answer stuff. And there's not a whole lot of thought put into which arguments those are or whatever. I think that's a – I don't know if that's a relatively recent phenomenon. I'm sure people have been doing that forever. But one thing that I think – people would be well advised to do is if you have the choice between adding another, you know, bad off case position that there's no chance you're going to go for or adding a few more case cards, add those case cards, especially if your strategy is a critique that you might need the case arguments, to complement, or a counterplan DA strategy where you might need the case arguments to beat a solvency deficit or just to have the DA outweigh the cases. It's better to invest, you know, reading a couple of extra case cards instead of that extra bad DA that there's really no chance of you going for. The other thing that was mentioned that I think is really a good suggestion is to cross-ex, before the cross-ex of the 2AC, is to prep for that. I'm not sure when that started, but I think the first time I saw someone do that might have even just been last year, but since I saw that, I've been teaching students to do that, and I think it's a really good way to make sure that the block gets off to a good start, because it forces the 2N and the 1N to talk to each other and forces them to think about what they're going to, how they're going to distribute the block, and then it allows the 1N to formulate a cross-ex strategy instead of just standing up and then asking kind of random questions. I've suggested this to some people, and they've kind of looked at me odd or whatever. I know Roy is a fan of this. What do you think about that, Scott? Is that a strategy that you like? Are there disadvantages to taking, you know, 30 seconds of prep time or something before the cross-ex?
Well, I don't believe in kind of debate democracy, so I don't really know that there should be a conversation. I think more the 2N should dictate.
Yeah,
1N should kind of do what they're told. So I don't really know that they need to, like, first of all, I think taking prep time before cross-ex is just, like, lame in general. I don't know. It's just like, couldn't you have discussed this in the closing seconds of the 2AC is the thing it always makes me think of. Press time is, like, a really precious commodity, and I think teams just, like, willy-nilly waste it. And so that bothers me a lot. But in terms of, like, you know, figuring it out and whatnot, I think that kind of like what you wrote in that judge methodology thing or whatever, that you're kind of like thinking about it as it goes on. Like, I think you should be figuring this out as the 2AC happens instead of like waiting to discuss it at the end. So I think you should have a pretty good idea in, you know, by in the closing moments of the 2AC, what's going to happen. And the 2NC should just be like, you're taking this, this, and this. I'm taking that. And then like go.
Yeah.
But even then, it's just like, you know, if, like, for 10 seconds after the 2AC, the 2N's just like, you're going to take politics and make sure you kick out of the K and answer that theory argument. You know, that would just, like, prevent kick-out mistakes. It's not like use a minute to have a, you know, yay or nay to this strategy option. It's kind of like just, you know, a clarifying thing. Obviously, you could use the last 10 seconds of the 2AC to do that too, but, you know, we're not talking about using minutes here to deliberate. It's more of just like, just to ensure everyone's on the same page about what's going on. I don't see like the 10 seconds being a huge disadvantage to that.
The other thing is, this kind of goes along with what I mentioned before, that I think a lot of times students don't really know what they should be doing during prep time. Is if you watch the one end during the 2AC, usually they will be either sitting down but then standing up and walking over to get the cards, or just, you know, sitting right next to where the speaker is, and they'll get every card that's read, every page that's read, and if you watch them, they'll kind of be, it looks like they're reading them, which I assume is what they're doing. Read every card, and then that's kind of the end of it. It doesn't seem like anything comes out of reading all of these cards. You know, they read all of the DA cards, they read all of the case cards, maybe one will get talked about in the cross-ex, but that's really it. I think that I'm not sure when that started either, where, I mean, it's important to make sure that nothing gets missed, but the preparation strategy where it's like, step one, read every card the other team read on every issue, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, especially when the result of that is that people aren't thinking about the debate, aren't thinking about interactions and stuff. One thing that I think would be helpful for either the 1N or the 2N to do, probably the 1N during the 2AC, is to just take a separate sheet of paper or a notepad or whatever and write down a list of like a checklist of the kickouts or the theory arguments or the whatever that need to be addressed. So, you know, you got Kondo, you got picks, you got states counterplan bad, and you've got, you know, kick out of DA number one. And then that, you know, 10 to 15 second right before the cross-ex of the 2AC, they can, you know, put 1NR or 2NC next to each of those, make sure those are all set, and that would, you know, efficiently avoid those kind of stupid drops. And it would also avoid what I think is really annoying, which is where after the cross-ex of the 2AC is over during the prep time for the 2NC, either the 2N or the 1N is like, by the way, AF, what were all your theory arguments? And then the AF, like, struggles to list all of the theory arguments they've made, and then the NEG's like, well, which of those are reasons to reject the team? And then the AF kind of thinks about that and tries to respond to that. I think that's a place where NEG teams are wasting a ton of prep time on something that really should be known. And I think part of the problem is the 1N seems to always just be reading cards, which is important on critical issues, but not when it's at the expense of, you know, just knowing what was in the speech and just flowing. I have a feeling that you agree with that, Scott, but does that make sense to you?
Yeah, were you saying that was contrary to something that I had said a second ago?
No, I just think, because I remember you wrote, I'm not sure if this was on your blog or if it was on the 3NR, but you wrote about the 2N preparation process, and I think this might have even been in the context of paperless or something, but like, if you have your, you know, cap K, you know what the 2A is going to say, and you don't really need to read all the cards to decide what strategy to go for or whatever. It just seems like 2A, we've taught students that it's important to read the evidence and review the evidence, which I obviously believe in, but the result of that has kind of been the 1N reads all the cards, and that's what they consider prep time. No one really flows, and a lot of, you know, kind of stupid mistakes like Roy described happen just because no one's really listening to the debate except for the judge. Do you think, I mean, what would you suggest a 1N be doing during the 2AC? Kind of, obviously they need to be flowing and they need to be getting blocks and stuff, but kind of what should the 1N be thinking about, during the 2AC?
Well, I mean, people who give the 1N, like Roy, they're basically just dancing monkeys. Like, they're there to read the 1NC and, like, take the perm in the 1NR on the K. That's, like, about all they do. So, I mean, during prep time, I guess they should be, like, giving the 2NC a back rub or, I don't know, getting them a drink, making themselves useful somehow. But I totally agree with what you said, that the emphasis on, like, reading evidence. It's like, yes, reading evidence is, like, super important, but in, like, the hierarchy of priorities, flowing is infinitely more important than reading evidence. And so if it's interfering with your flowing, I definitely don't think you should read evidence. But I think that I think that reading evidence is something better done before the 2NR than before the 2NC, because in considering what to go for in the block, there's probably a lot of potential evidence that you could read, whereas after the 1AR, you know, theoretically there are less issues and the AF has collapsed down their answers there. So there's less evidence that you would have to read to get ready to make comparisons or figure out what are threatening arguments, et cetera. So I think you end up reading a lot of superfluous evidence if your aim is to just read everything the 2AC says.
It seems, well, I appreciate your compliments about the 1N. That's why you had some great 1NR partners like Seagov out there to give you good back rubs. But the issue for me is kind of like, I don't understand what they're doing with reading the evidence because it doesn't get translated into the cross-ex anyway. So it seems like just read the evidence while the 2NC is going on since you already have around 13 minutes of prep.
Well, can we put this on pause for a second, Roy, because what you just said there I think is so really important. And one of the kids in my lab this summer, after me repeatedly jabbering him about this, was just basically like, well, what should I be reading this evidence to look for? So, like, what you're saying there, bringing it up in the cross-ex, like, I guess in the broad strokes, kids understand, like, if there's, like, a bad car, read part of it and, like, make fun of them. But, like, what specifically are you looking for kids to do in the cross-ex? Like, what would be an effective use of evidence for you in the cross-ex, and how would they go about doing it?
Well, to me, and this is sort of what I talk about in the cross-ex lectures, that it seems as if people aimlessly ask questions about a single card or a single, a single argument being made without sort of relating it to the big picture. For me, if I was cross-exing the 1NC, or if I was cross-exing the 2A, then I would, let's say, look at the politics dissed, and I'd say that my goal here is to take apart the politics dissed. So I'd start off with their uniqueness cards and sort of talk about how the uniqueness cards don't say it definitely won't pass. It'd say that there's political resistance, yada, yada, yada. I'd then go to the link arguments that they're reading, like link turns and stuff like that, and, you know, talk about why their link turn arguments aren't necessarily true. And sort of then move my way down to, like, if they read any impact defense or something like that. It seems more like people are asking, like, in the cross-ex, two types of questions. One, where does this evidence say this? And then don't really follow up with that. And then two, it's like, what is the warrant for that argument / what is that argument? And it doesn't seem like they utilize the evidence in a manner that sort of takes apart a dissed. I think it was like watching the Veen Ramachandrapa debate once against a Michigan State team, where in the cross-ex he just made everything the 2NC took go away. You know, it was just like from the uniqueness to the link to the impact, you know, bam, bam, bam. If you just ask a question about your uniqueness card and then move on to another sheet of paper and then be like, what are the reasons why conditionality is a voting issue? You know, you're not sort of getting a goal out of the cross-ex. You're just like making small points, but you're not really taking apart something. And I think that, you know, you make your life a lot easier if instead of saying, you know, proving that their uniqueness card was bad here and that their impact takeout, you know, on the dissed on another sheet was bad, if you just made one, you know, position that they were on, you know, all their answers go away, you're using your time a lot more effectively. It seems as if kids are looking for questions to ask, or like they're struggling to find questions to ask rather than attacking the cross-ex with an objective of what they want to get out of it. So if you're going to read the evidence, but make sure you're writing down questions and that, you know, you have a targeting approach there and not just the, you know, broad strokes questions that don't really get you anywhere.
I think that's really good advice. That was what I was going to say is I think that last thing, that people kind of approach cross-ex looking for questions to ask instead of approaching cross-ex strategically and then asking questions based on that strategy. I think two things that people can do in the cross-exes that I usually find most persuasive or most effective. First thing is to resolve interactions between arguments. So those are hard to kind of debate in a speech. If there are two negative arguments that are mutually exclusive, or if there is tension between two different affirmative responses, like we talked about the politics 2ACs where they'll have different interpretations of fiat or whatever. The cross-exes that kind of resolve how arguments interact and then make a determination about sort of which argument takes priority or what the affirmative or negative, whatever side you're on, needs to do to respond to an argument. I think that can be very effective. Second thing is trying to find some level of agreement about a certain issue. So if it's a politics uniqueness debate, cross-sex the uniqueness evidence, and based on the justification the affirmative provides in the 2AC, for example, for why their uniqueness evidence is better, kind of ask for agreement that, therefore if we win, that our evidence is actually better given that filter, do we win the uniqueness debate or whatever? So if their defense is, our evidence is from a more qualified expert, so qualification should be the determination of uniqueness, whatever, try and find some agreement about kind of ways to evaluate a certain argument. I think that can be very effective. So, how do we evaluate the link? How do we evaluate uniqueness? How do we evaluate the alternative? Stuff like that. And then like Roy said, and this is a big part of his CrossX lecture, which you can download from my Mediafire account. And if I remember, I'll try and post the link on the podcast post. But focusing on one argument and winning that argument or sort of achieving something on that argument is much more useful and much more effective than chipping away a little bit at a bunch of different arguments, because those minor chips that you might get on four arguments in your cross-sex are not going to translate into speech time saving, and they're not going to win the argument, whereas focusing on an argument and chipping away substantially at that argument can correlate into less speech time being needed to invest on that argument, or just winning that argument. So focusing in the cross-sex is really important. I'm curious, I guess, Scott, what do you think the most effective cross-sexes that you see do, or how do they approach the cross-sex or whatever? Because it seems like, I would imagine that all three of us can agree that the vast majority, vanishingly small amounts of cross-sexes are actually effective and strategic and persuasive or whatever. So what is it that you see in cross-sexes that you like that you think debaters could do more of to kind of improve their cross-sexing?
Well, I think debaters now seem to be too focused on like immediate gratification. They're just like, isn't your dissent stupid? And then the other team is like, no. And then that's like it. They like drop it and move on. It's like, no, I hate when people ask opinion questions in cross-sex. Like, doesn't this evidence say that it might not pass? It's like the other team is never going to agree to that, obviously. Also, the same thing happens when they like read like three sentences of the card in isolation. And then they're like, well, and they hand the card to the other team, and then they just read a different three sentences that has like nothing to do with resolving the issue. And it's like a totally drop point. So I think what you need to do is you need to, like, set questions up. You can't just be like, doesn't this card say nothing? You need to, like, ask a series of questions that gets the other team to commit to saying things that then help your case. So, like, the classic example of this is the, like, threshold issue where, like, let's say the AF has an economy advantage. You, like, get one of their uniqueness cards, and you're like, well, this card says that, the economy is already declining now, so why haven't we seen the impact? And then they'll say something stupid, like setting up an arbitrary threshold for where the economy needs to be in order for there to, like, see the impact to get them out of the fact that the uniqueness for their advantage is bad. And then you ask a follow-up question that proves that, like, the AF can't do that much to fix the economy or something. So it's like you need to have, like, that 1-2 punch. You can't just, like, ask them a question and expect them to concede their whole case. So you need to think about, like, what questions can I ask, and then how can I use follow-up questions to make them, whatever answer they gave, hurt them in some other way.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I just was typing out that I wanted to bring up, was that there are no follow-up questions. It's one question. It's like, your uniqueness of evidence, does it say that healthcare will pass? Where does it, no, okay, and then moving on, Like, there's no building up, there's none of that, where you sort of, like Bill said, make your bigger point with the second question or the third question. So you've gotta, have your eye on the prize of what you want there, and then keep moving forward with your questions in that progression, and make sure that you don't kind of, just give up after a question. At the same time, asking like the same question 14 times in a row is not gonna get the response if they're not answering it. You need to find a different way of getting there. This is a little bit, this is a little bit off topic, but related to what the 1NR should do. I realized that I forgot to add this into the 1NR post, but the other thing that I find people do, like, problems that the 2NR has with the prep time is because they can't find any of their evidence. And, you know, obviously this is a paper issue, not a paperless issue. I understand, Scott. But or they can't find the opponent's evidence. And I think that's something that the 1NR should really be doing is right after the 1NR is done, the 1NR should take all of the cards that they read and crosshatch them appropriately. And, you know, if it's on the disad, uniqueness, link, and impact, if it's on the case, you know, different case flows and stuff like that, and have that kind of ready for the 2NR so that the 2NR, when they're prepping, can look through evidence, can take that evidence up with them and have that ready to go. So, you know, you finish with the 1NR, you get everything that you read, put it together in an order, leave it for the 2N on the side, and then ask the 2N, is there anything that you need, you know, back rub, cup of coffee, highlight, you know, look, you know, write out some warrants for some evidence or something like that, and kind of do that for them. And just like, don't sort of just sit there and watch the debate, you know, develop without you being involved in it. Like, you can play a large role. You can write out answers to like 1AR cards that are read and warrants and stuff like that. Don't just sort of be a casual observer once your speech is done. Play a role in that and help the 2NR because, you know, especially in high school debates, I've seen a lot of 2Ns recently just guzzle 2NC prep time. So they're left with like a minute and a half, 2 minutes max of, you know, 2NR prep time, and that's costing them debates where if the 1NR did a lot of that stuff, they would be saving their partners a lot of time and make it easier for them to give a higher quality speech.
Well, let me ask you something about what you said there. You said they should kind of like cross-hatch their evidence and get it ready for the 2NC so the 2NC can bring it up.
For the 2NR.
Yeah, sorry. I don't understand what like utility function is served by this. Whenever I see kids do this, it's inevitably for them to just give a bibliography style 2NR of like, extend all of our link cards. We got Johnson and we got Smith, we got Seinfeld and the Warnstein.
Well, let's say it's like on the uniqueness to like a disad and you've got like the uniqueness warrants written out to the side of your evidence there. The 2NR can be like, you know, we control the direction of the uniqueness, extend our Washington Post evidence. You know, it says this, this, and this, and this, and this. You know, like the 2NRs usually are just like, extend our uniqueness cards, it says it'll win. But here if they are like, Washington Post says 1, 2, 3. New York Times says 1, 2. You know, I think it makes the speech sound better and at least gives you some, a better ability to explain the warrants. I mean, obviously when it's done.
Well, no, yeah, I mean, I can't disagree poorly, with you that giving warrants makes the speech sound better, but I guess.
When it's done poorly, it's just tags, you're right.
Why write the warrants on the side of the evidence instead of just getting a new sheet of paper and writing like uniqueness evidence warrants at the top and listing them?
As long as you've got warrants, you can do it whatever which way, but, you know, it's nice to reference, you know, a card and a reason to do it, especially some judges are nitpicky about not extending a card by sight or something like that, you know. I mean, it's just kind of like protect there, and it at least gives the 2N the ability to read, the 2N can have those cards, even if they're not going to extend it bibliography style, they can at least have them there so that they can read them before the 2NR. And be able to explain them, especially if they, you know, didn't take the position in the 1NR.
I gotta disagree. If you haven't read the cards for it before the round, you probably shouldn't be going for it.
I mean, I guess, but I mean, if it's like politics uniqueness, maybe it's like the first round of the tournament, and you haven't gone for this politics DA yet, and, you know, it's in the 1NR, like, if you might not know the warrants to all of the healthcare world pass arguments, but you understand the healthcare DA enough to go for it, I think that that's kind of arbitrary.
Well, I guess that sort of segues into a couple of things that I had written down that I was going to ask you guys about the 2NR. But I'll start with, I think that there are two styles of 2NR. There's the style of the 2NR that's more like a constructive speech in which the method for extending evidence that Roy originally described or that Scott, labeled it as, is used, so it's like, you know, uniqueness debate. We have this piece of evidence that says this. We have this piece of evidence that says this. We have this piece of evidence that says this. Prefer this one because it says this or because it takes into account this. We have more evidence than they do. We have better evidence than they do, whatever. Now link. We have this link. Prefer this link evidence. We have this link. You know, it takes out their link turn, whatever. And that, I think too many 2NRs, even very good 2NRs, are very kind of line by line extension, sort of bullet point extension of things that have been argued in the block. The other style of 2NR is the style that kind of makes more decisions about what to focus on and then builds a argument and then uses the evidence and references to evidence to support the argument. So if it's a uniqueness debate on politics, on healthcare, and the negative wants to go for their healthcare good to set. So on the uniqueness component of the debate, they need to win that healthcare is going to pass. One style would just extend each of the pieces of uniqueness evidence and maybe have one or two prefer our evidence claims. The other style would have maybe the best reason that healthcare is more likely to pass than not pass, with citation then of a couple of pieces of evidence that might support that claim, and then perhaps a reason that that style or that specific warrant that has been explained trumps the competing warrants that the other team's evidence has. So instead of extending five reasons that healthcare will pass, you extend your best reason, you cite a couple of pieces of evidence that support it, and then you explain why that trumps the competing warrants of the other side. I've seen very few speeches that take that style, even on like critique debates, but sometimes I guess the critique 2NRs are the speeches that are a little bit more like that, where they're more argument-focused than extension-focused, I guess is the best way that I can explain it. I know that you can obviously go too far in that direction and just drop a bunch of stuff and not really be covering. But do you think that debaters would be better served kind of practicing an argument-centered style of 2NR, or do you think that just kind of improving the bullet point extensions at the margins is enough and that that's a better style of 2NR? I guess I won't ask Roy this. I'll ask Scott this, because otherwise Scott will make a joke about how Roy is the one end. So go ahead, Scott.
Well, I mean, I think obviously intellectually, I think you and I would agree that the kind of warrant-centered version is the better one. But I think that two factors lead kids to do the other one. First is that there's a large segment of judges who are willing to just, like, call for the cards, read them, and then figure out who they think has better evidence. And so with those kind of judges, you know, how much fancy spin you put on warrants, you know, is largely irrelevant. But I think the second reason that kids just don't do that as much is that, you know, people don't require them to. Like, rarely do you see a judge on a panel say something like, well, you just didn't explain a warrant for this card, so I gave you no credit for it or whatever. Do you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. I guess those two reasons are like pretty related, although kind of I see them as being distinct because I think,
you know, what Roy said earlier, like, you have to extend it. To me, it's much more important that you say, you know, extend healthcare will pass due to X issue. X issue is the most important than it is to say, like, extend Washington Post 9, healthcare will pass. But I think for the majority of judges, it's kind of the opposite on those things.
Do you agree with that, Roy?
No. I think that – I guess there's two different distinctions on two levels. The first is I think that it's important to differentiate going for a dissent, I think, versus going for a critique, especially when it's, you know, evidence intensive. I guess I think that the warrant-based stuff that you were talking about is not exclusive of referencing evidence. I think that you can sort of be like, you know, extend the healthcare uniqueness, will win healthcare will pass three reasons, one, two, three, you know, and then give the reason why your warrants outweigh theirs and then still explain, you know, how the Washington Post evidence says this and this evidence says that. I think that, you know, it's not just a bullet point thing. But I think that, so the first distinction is going for a K or going for a counter plan or something like that, rather than just going for a dissed where you're reading a lot of cards on. The second thing that I think that your sort of explanation argument or more warrant-based argument serves the affirmative a lot better than it serves the negative, because the affirmative can sort of pick and choose a key warrant that they think that the negative undercovered or didn't answer, didn't deal with, and then exploit that with extensive analysis. I think that the 2NR oftentimes, just because it is such a difficult speech, is kind of forced to give more of a constructive-like 2NR where they sit on impact assessment at the top and then sort of go through what they're winning, especially if they're going for a dissent in the counterplan or a dissent in the case, and sort of need to get through that stuff. The 2AR has the luxury of picking arguments they can sit on. So I'm more a fan of, like, you know, being a 2A of picking one or two key arguments and sort of exploiting the negative's errors there. But I think that as a 2N, you kind of need to be able to give more of the bibliography and warrant stuff rather than just, you know, storytelling type argument.
Yeah, that was kind of that was sort of the origin of that question. That was kind of what I was getting toward. Is it seems like the 2A in the 2AR is held to a standard of explanation that's higher than the level of explanation that the 2NR is held to, and that's obviously for good reason. But I think that the more 2AR-ish the 2N can get on crucial issues, because usually there will be, you know, if it's a healthcare will pass, won't pass debate, or if it's a, you know, plan, popular, unpopular debate, or whatever, there are a lot of cards, there are a lot of arguments or warrants that probably could be extracted from the evidence, but really there's maybe one or two fundamental arguments on each side. And so if it's a politics uniqueness card, you know, it might be momentum, you know, the relative amount of political capital that Obama is investing in the, in whatever the piece of legislation is or whatever. And so the, you know, different pieces of evidence from different sources will kind of cite the same arguments. They'll cite the same quotes from people in Congress and whatever. And the more that the 2N can kind of take that large, you know, uniqueness debate and turn it into one uniqueness, question versus, you know, 15 or, you know, that's probably too many, maybe 8 individual uniqueness questions that are based on the individual pieces of evidence, the better they are to cope with 2ARs that do a good job of making decisions and focusing on one argument. So the more, I guess the what I'm trying to say is the more the 2N can wrap a large issue like uniqueness on politics into a single story while still answering the stuff that the affirmative could say, the better they will be served when the judge has to compare their explanation to the 2A's explanation, because the 2A obviously has the benefit of knowing what the negative has said. Then the other thing I want to mention quickly, and I would be interesting to get your thoughts about this. One thing I find myself telling 1Ns in particular after debates, because often, you know, I'll mention things about the 2NR or whatever, and the 1N will say, you know, like, well, what could I have done better in my 1NR, is to set up the 2NR more. I think that the way that positions get debated in the block largely determines the way that those positions are extended in the 2NR. And so the more, the phrase that I usually use, or that I find myself using when describing this is like scaffolding. I think that the 2NC and the 1NR kind of establish, the basic, framing for the 2NR. And so the more, that scaffolding can be constructed efficiently and kind of in a way that's well organized, the better the 2NR will be in explaining it. So if you have three arguments on uniqueness on politics, if there is a place where you have listed those arguments and then had some, you know, one or two pieces of evidence to support each of them, that is a cleaner 1NR for the 2NR to extend than if you just read 9 pieces of uniqueness evidence with just tags or whatever. So the more kind of structure you can provide in the block, the better off the 2NR will be. Can you, I guess first, do you guys agree with that? And then are there other things that you think the block can do to make the 2NR easier? Because I think the 2NR obviously is very difficult, and, you know, it's difficult speech for anyone to give, much less, you know, high school students that aren't maybe the, you know, the very best high school students. So what can they do to improve the 2NR by improving the block? What improvements in the block can be made that would be helpful for the 2NR?
Yeah, I like this, like, scaffolding concept that you just got there, because I think that kids don't understand, like, the usefulness of this. So, like, if you're debating politics uniqueness and you just read 8 cards and the 1AR groups it and says, like, 4 things, like, when the 2NR is like, oh, they've totally dropped this card and this card and this card, no one ever gives them credit for it because you didn't differentiate your arguments very well, so odds are the judge didn't even know you were making these alleged arguments that are now dropped. Whereas when the 1NR goes there and is like, you know, there's 3 relevant issues to resolve healthcare passage. 1, momentum. 2, moderate support. 3, some other crap. And then explains why those things are, like, really important, and then the 1AR groups it and gives, like, 3 or 4 arguments. You can breeze through uniqueness in the 2NR and just be like, look, the 1AR dropped all of this stuff. We already impacted why it was important in the 1NR. No new 2AR arguments, and that's, like, over, I think. And so I think that that's, like, a really important concept. It's like, I don't know, I'm terrible with this, but it's either vertical or horizontal, one of those kinds of prolif.
Vertical.
This stupid analogies, yeah. So I think that that's, like, the way to do it instead of just reading, like, a million more cards on those issues is really developing. And I think that's, like, the one leg up that critique teams generally have is they kind of get these blocks filtered down from like elder anti-capitalist hippies, and they've kind of put in all the time to draw these things out. And that's like the advantage of the like one-off K is that you have all these like millions of warrants that you can then utilize in like very specific fashions. So when people actually do that, it's like a pretty devastating strategy.
Yeah, I think that those arguments are most effective in two places. The first is impact assessment. I think that a good impact assessment overview by the, you know, 2NTR, the 1NR can really make the 2NR's life a lot easier in explaining the impacts, you know, especially if there's a good conceded DA turns the case argument or anything like that. It kind of sets up the framework for which the 2NR will give that impact order. And then I think that we talked about this in a previous podcast, or I'm just a huge fan of the general numbering slash big picture type thing, because just like that, like what Scott said with uniqueness, like if you were like, you know, when you got to the, you know, on the counterplan, if like the 2AC was like CP doesn't solve the case, and then you kind of made a structured counterplan solves the case for three reasons type arg, 1, 2, 3, rather than just reading cards that like, yes it does, it solves this advantage, then the 2NR can get to that sheet, you know, point and be like, look, you know, we'll win the counterplan solves the case for three reasons, and then have those reasons already there. And I think that the other thing that's understated is that the judge has that float in that way on their flow now. So when the 2NR gets there, it doesn't become like a foreign concept. It kind of is like the 2NR sort of building up on something that the block has already done. And it makes your flow a lot easier to resolve as a judge. And it, you know, it just looks better on the flow when you can be like after the block, okay, well, they're like CP solves the case 1, 2, 3, or on uniqueness, three reasons it will pass, and then kind of do that, that it makes it a lot easier for you to see that connection, because a lot of the time the judge is kind of waiting for the 2NR to finish the story, whereas the 2NR can kind of be, you know, building that story now rather than just like making it anew in the 2NR. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I think one other thing that is helpful when you do the kind of numbering or big picture structuring in the block is to try and be conscious of what you want the judge to remember and to write down. We might have actually talked about this in a previous podcast, but it's certainly something I've talked about a lot, is you want to choose kind of labels that are going to be memorable for the judge and that are going to be easy for the 2N to extend. So instead of your explaining your link argument as, you know, number two, moderate Democrats in the Senate are going to decide to vote for the legislation, and we have this Washington Post evidence that says that, and here's more evidence, blah, blah, blah. First, give that link argument or that unique argument a label. So first is moderate Democrats. Then do your explanation. And so then in the 2NR, the 2N can say, extend our moderate Democrats warrant. And the judge can look back and they'll have written down moderate Democrats. Or, you know, the number two would be momentum, something like that. And make sure that you are, you know, slow down and emphasize that, because you want the judge to write that down. So even if the judge just has written down on the uniqueness section, one, moderate Democrats, two, momentum, and then some, like, X's to indicate that there are cards below that, the 2N will still get credit for a bunch of explanation that was done in the block, because the judge remembers that that's what was in the block. And that's another example, I think, like Scott said, where K-teams do a good job. They give kind of catchy names to their link arguments, or they have kind of catchy ways to explain an alternative argument. And judges write that down, and then when the 2NR says that term, they're getting credit for much more than the term. They're getting credit for kind of all the baggage that goes with that. So they're getting credit for explanation that was actually not even in their speech. And that's really the key in the 2NR, because you have to get as much explanation as possible into that speech. And if you can kind of get the judge to consider some explanation that was done in a previous speech, that's just golden for the 2NR. That should be your biggest goal, is to get the judge to consider as much of what you've already said as possible. And so thinking about how to package that, it's kind of, you know, we've been talking about the Reps K thing, and a lot of the, you know, the Reps K cards, the Framework Institute's cards or whatever, are about the importance of the way that we frame issues. I think that can be applied not just to policy issues, but also to debate. You know, think about how you're framing your arguments, and, you know, think about that, especially in debates that you've lost or debates where judges have given kind of negative feedback about something. You know, like even if you win the debate, but you might have lost a uniqueness argument, you know, ask how could I better explain that uniqueness argument, and be conscious of how it was framed, and just the simple labeling and simple kind of distinguishing arguments by taglines and stuff can be a very effective way to set up the 2NR and make the 2NR an easier speech, because it's obviously very hard, and anything you can do to improve it obviously is something you should do. I guess the other question I was going to ask before about the 2NR, I guess I'll start with Scott. How do you think, how much of the decision about what to go for in the 2NR should be dependent upon pre-round decisions and you know, kind of strategic determinations? How much should be based on the block, sort of the 2AC block, and how much should be based on the 1AR? So kind of if you're the 2N, you're listening to the 1AR, what's going through your mind as you're thinking about how to make the decision about what to go for in the 2NR? And then the second question is, what role does the 1N have, if any, in either making the decision or executing the decision? So in other words, as the 1N is flowing the 1AR and listening to the 1AR, what should they be doing? What role do they play? So I guess first thing is, how do you decide? Second thing is, what role, if any, does the 1N have in that?
Well, in terms of what pre-round thing should affect it, I think there's only a couple of things. One is, if before the round you know you have no idea what the K is about, and so it's going to be like impossible for you to go for it, then that obviously could affect your decision. And second, if you know that like one of your arguments is like unwinnable, so if you read like a BS politics DA to just suck some time, and you know your evidence is terrible, so you can't go for that, then I think those are pre-round considerations that could affect your decision. But other than that, I think you should always be aiming to make your decision based on what the AF said, instead of kind of sticking to dogma that you thought of before the round. So I think that kind of relevant factors to consider is like strength of your arguments versus their arguments. And so factors in the strength of your argument are like quality of evidence, time spent on it, quality of explanation, those kind of things. And so I think teams sometimes just either say they don't have a card, or they didn't spend time on this, or they read a bunch of evidence. And so that's only one facet of the quality equation that you need to balance against other things. The second thing that you should also filter in, and I think one and two in certain circumstances can flip importance, is who's judging your debate. So if you have someone who's obviously not likely to vote on an issue like T theory, something like that, then, you know, that should affect your decision of what you want to go for. And that can be more important than argument quality, or it can be less important than argument quality. And then I think the last thing that you want to consider is just how good are you doing kind of in terms of one position versus another. So what I mean is that you could be slightly ahead argument quality-wise on two issues in, like, the same way. And so what you need to think about is kind of a combination of the other factors that would tilt you between those two. So, like, example, let's say that you think you're kind of ahead on topicality and you think you're kind of ahead on a critique. Okay, so then how do you – once you've decided you think you can win on either of them, how do you decide which one to go for? Well, it's then I think you need to bring in like how good are you on those issues and how good is your judge on those issues. So don't just evaluate issues in a vacuum. Also kind of compare them. As to the 1NR, I think that like it's going to be different for each 2N how the 1NR can best help them. So for some of them, it might be like Roy was saying, getting all the evidence for you and writing out warrants and whatnot. For others, it might be, you know, writing out an overview for something or getting you some theory analytics typed out that you can then read. So I think that's going to be like way more different on a case-by-case basis than the kind of process of decision-making will be. And so that's going to be something that you're going to have to decide for yourself through kind of trial and error. I mean, it may be true that you would like an ideal 1NR to write out a bunch of warrants and evidence and stuff for you, but it may be the case that the person you're debating with is just not very good at that, and so then you'll have to kind of change it out based on the situation.
I don't think that the 1NR ever really gets to choose what the 2NR is going to go for. The 2NR sort of, you know, they have to live by that decision, and, you know, ultimately when the negative loses, it's usually the fault of the 2NR for either making a bad strategic decision or for just not executing. So, you know, you can sort of advise your partner and be like, you know, I think you should go for this. But after that, you know, there's no point in bickering with your partner over the issue just because it's not going anywhere. You know, I remember once having, you know, my senior year in an Elam debate discussion with my partner about what I thought he should go for. And he disagreed and then, you know, went for the thing and lost. And judges were like, should have gone for that. But I mean, you can sort of discuss that with your partner after the fact, but you can't fight with your partner like during the 2NR prep time over what they're going to go for. With regards to going for what the, you know, what the 2NR should go for, I think that obviously how well you think you're doing on the issue is important, but I think that the judge issue can't be kind of, you know, the judge thing shouldn't be underscored a lot. You know, we've got a 3NR podcast listener who talked to me about a loss that she suffered at St. Mark's, and it was like, I was killing him on this issue. You know, 99% of the judges would have voted for me on this argument, and I sort of explained to them that was like, you know, you had the 1% of the judge who didn't really care for that type of argument and wasn't going to vote on it. So, you know, the fact that you were doing well on it does not mean that, you know, X judge is going to feel that way. I think that, you know, a large percentage of the judging pool is kind of flexible, but, you know, you'll get judges in situations that aren't necessarily as flexible, and you need to be willing to adapt to what, you know, those judges like or dislike. You know, that's why writing down comments about what the judge says or how this judge is judged and reading their judge philosophy is really important, because, you know, you can use a lot of keywords for that. You know, I was just, Scott once gave me a tip when I was going for this ideology K, which if you told me right now what it meant, I'd have no idea, but I went for it in the 2NR. And I just kept talking about Lenin and Stalin because Scott was like, the judge loves hearing Lenin and Stalin references. And, you know, I just kept referencing Lenin and Stalin in the 2NR, and the judge ate it all up and voted for me on it. And I have no idea what I was talking about, but.
Yeah, you know, Roy thought that was a Beatles spinoff band.
Yeah, I just had no idea what any of that was going on, but, you know, Zizek ideology, Lenin and Stalin, it worked out. So, you know, knowing how the judge feels about issues and how they decide issues is really, really, really important. And I think that that's something that cannot be underscored by a 2AR and a 2NR in the decision making for what arguments they go for. If you know a judge is a stickler for AF gets to choose the framework, you know, Jared Atchison, AF choice, shotgun AF. If he's judging you, you should be talking about that in the 2AR when they go for a reps K, you know. Other judges, other things, but, you know, be able to adapt that 2NR to that.
How much, I guess this has sort of already been answered, but how much of the strategy or the decision, I guess, how much of the 2NR's decision should be based on an assessment of what you're good at or what you are most comfortable with versus what the opponent is weakest about? I guess what I mean is the sort of the way that I think about this, or the way that I would teach a 2N to make their decision, is that ultimately the argument that you are best on, or the argument that you are most confident in, you're going to debate better than the argument that you might think that you're more ahead on, or that the other team is weaker on. I think that that piece of advice, while I still think that's important, I think that unfortunately the result of that is that too many students kind of get locked in on, I can only go for this kind of thing, or the opposite, I can't go for this kind of argument because I did that once and it was a disaster, or because I'm not confident in that. Kind of how do you balance out, or how can you improve your ability to feel more comfortable going for different kinds of arguments? How much do you have to stick to your guns versus how much should you kind of try and expand your horizons, or expand the strike zone of arguments that you can go for? Because I think that's difficult, because we tell debaters to be more flexible, we tell them to be more versatile, but at the same time we want them to go for arguments they're more confident in. So I guess what advice would you have for people who are trying to kind of straddle that fence about confidence versus versatility?
Practice debates. Practice speeches. I mean, you said it earlier where you were just like, if this is, you know, you shouldn't, and maybe it was Scott too, I mean, I think all three of us agree with this, that if you can't go for it in the 2NR, it shouldn't be in the 1NC. Right? Like, if your decision before the 2NR is, I'm not very good at this, I don't think I can go for it, then why was it in the block? Why was it in the 1NC? You know, you should use your pre-tournament practice speeches when you're at institutes. You should expand your horizons on arguments that you can go for. When you're, you know, doing practice debates with your team, practice going for those arguments so that you feel more comfortable going for that argument. You know, I was talking to my sophomores who miraculously cleared at the University of Michigan tournament before their doubles debate, and I was just like, what about this? You know, this thing, they pulled it out to put in the 1NC, and I was like, can you go for this in the 2NR? Do you feel confident going for it? And they were like, no. And I was like, well, then why are we reading this? Why, you know, where is this going to get us in the debate round if you can't go for it at all? So I wouldn't try out, like, in a round 6 or a round 4 where, you know, you're down 1 or down 2 going for something that I haven't gone for. I'd use my pre-tournament time to decide that out, and I wouldn't keep anything in the block that I didn't think I could give a 2NR on, or else it just has no utility, really.
A couple of things. One is I think that it's less important to think of, like, how good am I on something, and it's much more important to figure out what is the gap between how good you are on something and how good your opponent is. So you might not be very good at the cap K, but if you're debating someone who's just god-awful on the cap K, you being, you know, semi-decent about it will be sufficient. So I think you got to think about, like, what is the relative skill differential on an issue. And in making those decisions, like, the lower the skill differential, so if the gap is only, like, 1 unit, let's say, going for that issue is going to be, like, very high variance. Like, you're not going to be able to win a large portion of the debates with a small differential in quality on that. So you need to go for things where you have a big differential in either how good you are at it or how far ahead you are on it, in order to kind of secure your victory and not just get, like, eaten up by variance at tournaments. But second, I think I agree with Roy that in practice debates, like, I tell my kids every summer that you should never read or go for things in practice debates that you've already gone for a lot. So if you spend a whole year going for the politics disset, when you get to camp, there's no need to read the politics disset a lot because you've gotten a lot of practice on it. Start going for T or going for a K or whatever. I mean, I never in my life, I think, went for a K until the TOC my junior year, we were like 0-3 and thus couldn't clear, and I was like, oh, I guess I can practice going for the K, and that's like, that was a pretty big milestone for me once I got good at that. So I think at tournaments, if you're not clearing anymore, that's a good time to experiment, but other than that, you know, it's got to stick to probably practice debates.
An issue of that is kind of like confidence, you know. Like, if you've convinced yourself that you're not sure you can win if you're going for it, then don't go for it. Because that's going to affect the quality of the speech that you kind of give on the issue, so.
Is Batterman sleeping?
I'm here.
Okay.
He might have the apnea thing. But, is your dog sleeping in the background, Batterman?
No, I'm still at school.
So someone's definitely sleeping. You have to have confidence in what you're going for, and if you don't have that confidence, you're not going to win that debate. So.
Yeah, I guess what, a lot of times, kids will make the wrong 2NR decision, or they will make a 2NR decision that, you know, it's kind of an iffy, you know, could have been the right decision, could have been the wrong decision, and after the debate, they will ask, you know, did I make the right 2NR decision, or, you know, I usually try and, you know, tell them what I think about that right away. How can students learn more from the decisions they make in the 2NR? How can they, I guess, as a judge, what kind of questions or how can they frame the question? I guess for me, the biggest thing is if a 2N says, you know, here's what I was thinking going into the 2NR, that's why I made my decision to go for this argument, I can better kind of, you know, see where they're coming from, say why I thought, you know, that was a good assessment of the debate or that was a bad assessment of the debate. What else, or, you know, if you have a comment about that, what can 2Ns do kind of after the fact, after they've already gone for something, given a 2NR? How can they get better feedback from judges, or how can they learn more from giving the 2NR and making decisions in the 2NR?
Well, I think they ask bad questions in the post-round, like, did I make the right decision? Is like a yes, no. What should I have gone for? It's like politics. I think the kind of things that you need to ask is not necessarily like, what were you thinking? Because I think people in general, like, they're not objective very often. And so I think, like, one thing people always say is, like, you need to judge debates, and that will make you a better debater because then you'll learn how to, you know, view the round more objectively, or you'll see how judges see things. And I think kids in debate a lot of times don't really think about things from the perspective of the judge. They think about things from the perspective of their side, influenced by what they think about the other team and their evidence and anything. So, like, the line of questioning that I would ask after his decision, assuming, like, I gave the 2 and R, went for the wrong thing, and lost, so obviously this is a hypothetical. I would ask, like, a series of questions. Like, I would say, you know, I would say,
are you an idiot? You voted against me? Do you know who I am?
I'm not Chadoan, but I would say, what of the factors that we kind of talked about earlier, like evidence disparity, time disparity, skill disparity, would lead you as the judge to think that I should have gone for something else? And then I would kind of compare my assessment versus the judge's assessment. And then I would think about, is this something that I'm being biased or the judge is being biased, or was I objectively kind of wrong about this? And so one of those three things has to be the case. If it's that you were biased, then obviously you need to change the way you're thinking and less what you're thinking about. If the judge is biased, then that's obviously something you want to write down for the next time they judge you. And if it's just objectively you were wrong about it, you need to think about, like, what factors led me to this wrong way of thinking about the issue. So maybe you thought, oh, the 1AR didn't spend much time on this. And then the judge is like, well, I don't think the 1AR amount of time was relevant because of XYZ. That might be an indicator that you're too heavily weighting 1AR time allocation and kind of your thought process of what to go for in the 2&R. So that's kind of the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is I would, like, think about things later. So I think, like, a cooling off period is really necessary for you to kind of objectively evaluate things that happened in the debate. And I would think about what kind of similar situations could arise. So not necessarily what would I do if this exact thing happened again, but what would I do if something similar happened? So thinking about those things ahead of time will give you kind of a mental yardstick for making those decisions quicker in the future, because you've already kind of thought about the potential possibilities that could happen.
Yeah, I don't really disagree with that very much. The one thing I would add is sort of like the question of, is there a winning 2&R to be given on the issue that I went for? I think that, you know, it sort of becomes the question, like, oftentimes it'll just be like, all right, you lost, and then it'll be like, well, should I have gone for something else instead? Well, maybe it's not that you should have gone for something else, but I think that there's a winning 2&R that could be given by doing this, that, or the other, you know, with the issues that you've gone for. So sort of ask judges questions, not, you know, in the, are you an idiot, why did you vote against me, but to sort of understand what they're thinking. And then, like Scott said, compare notes on that. But then also you have notes now on what that judge thinks is, you know, the truth on the issue. So, you know, makes it a lot easier to understand. Right, Bill?
Definitely.
So, I don't know do you think we should get to your topic tonight, since we're pretty deep in here? Or should we just save that for a pre-Glenbrook's treat?
We can save that for a pre-Glenbrook's treat.
Yeah, I think that's probably better than, because that's a big topic to discuss.
Yeah, I just remembered that there was a bunch of people who posted in the last podcast thread.
What did they say?
There was a couple of topics that got brought up there. So the first one was effectively go for T in the 2&R. I think we kind of talked about this a little bit last time, but
yeah.
I think that what Bill said about structure is, like, really important for topicality, and that if you're a good 2NC on topicality, we'll have, like, explanation of the interpretation, reason the AF doesn't meet, list of cases that do meet, list of cases that don't meet, multiple offensive reasons for why the list of cases that do meet are better to debate, combined with a large series of defensive arguments against the AF offense. And once you have that, like, all blocked out, then the 2&R becomes really easy, because you just zero in on one or two offensive arguments that the AF did the worst on, and then just spend the rest of your time winning defense against any offense that they have. And it's, like, pretty simple formula.
Didn't I ask you what you thought about this last week, and you were like, I don't think you should do any of that?
No, the Rishi question Batra, about overviews, I think.
He just said, oh, Rishi Batra, compare notes on what Scott just said on topicality tonight versus last week's podcast, and provide us with an analysis. You are our official scribe / bookkeeper here. I'm pretty sure, because I was like, I think you should do this in the, you know, they do all that stuff at the top, and you're like, no, don't do it. Blah.
Well, yeah, I don't necessarily think it needs to all be in the overview. I just think those are components of things. Like, obviously you don't put defense to AF offense in the overview. Surely
sure.
We can agree on that.
Yeah.
Surely we can.
What Scott just described was, like, the entire T speech. The question you had asked was about you know, how extensive the overview should be versus, or how much content should be in the overview versus on the line by line. And he, and I were more of the line by line, I think, and you were more of the overview.
Yeah.
That's how I remember.
All right. Well, we'll have Rishi compare. What were some other questions?
All right, the next one I think is pretty interesting. It says, MPJ general strategy. Maybe things such as how to balance out rounds and prelims, as well as how to balance K-friendliness with overall experience. So I think one thing that jumps to my mind that I don't think very many people think about is the out rounds versus prelims thing, because I didn't even really think about this ever until maybe like the last tournament that I went to in college, which prior to the NDT, since you get a separate – prep sheet for the elims there, but I never really thought about, like, they're thinking about what judges will be around on elim day and then organizing your strikes around that. I would just, like, sit down and be like this judge, like that judge smells bad, this is an idiot, and that's kind of how I filled it out. And then, like, at finals, when there's only, like, four judges in the tri-state area, you know, you end up a lot of times getting just, like, an awful mix that you do not want to be debating in front of. And so instead, you need to think about, like, what teams are going to be – well, I guess the caveat to this is that if you stink, this is not
a good situation. Well, yeah, that's the most important. But that's not a caveat, though. That's, I think, the most important issue. I think it's centered around what type of team are you. You know, you can't be picky and choosy if you're on the brink Elim team here. If you're a team that needs to clear or that has trouble clearing, like, you need to be all over that. You need to be have the best judges that you could possibly have. You can't sort of strike based off of, you know, type of preference, you know, or based off strategy, you know, that type of strategy there.
Well, best kind of judge, I don't know if this was you, I talked about this with Roy, but, like, if you're not very good, then, like, really line-by-line technical judges, like, at D height are, like, awful for you.
Sure.
No, so, like, the best kind of judge, that's, like, depends on what kind of team you are, I think.
Yeah, but, I mean, if you're kind of bad, you sort of need some of that good judging to help you get better, too, you know? Like, at some level, it's an educational aspect plus the, you know, plus the win-loss thing. But I think that striking for Elim Day, I think striking for Elim Day, though, is the strategy for that is twofold. The first is that a coach of someone whose team is in Elims, you know? Like, if they're in Elims a lot, then you know that they'll be judging. So you don't necessarily want to keep them there. And then the second is kind of their ideological preferences in general. And I think that the way I do it now is, you know, I fill out the core of judges that I like that I want, and then I look at some of the riskier judges and say, who are we likely to get that judge in front of in an elim, and does that matchup work out for us? So a lot of the more K-friendly judges who would be fine for us in preliminary rounds, you know, or even in general, I might move lower / strike because I know that, you know, XK judge is a judge that I'll get against, you know, a K judge I'll get against like a Westlake or, you know, more K-friendly team like Kincaid or something like that, whereas I might not want them, you know, in the quarters in that spot. But I think that you sort of have to have an understanding of where your team is on the clear / not clear spectrum. And then, yes, Scott is right that, you know, if they're not – your team isn't awesome, you might not want the most tech-friendly, you know, judge out there because your team's obviously not that great at the tech. But, you know, the Elim strike card is kind of the last thing where it's like, once you've reached the top level, then you do your MPJ based off of, you know, who is this judge going to judge me against, and do I want them in that spot or not?
Yeah, I guess I agree with that. I think that most debaters now have grown up going to a majority of their circuit tournaments where they get MPJ, and I think part of the problem is that teams have specialized to the extent that certain judges they think are bad judges for them because the arguments they go for are very limited. And so the more flexible you are, the more judges, good judges, you can legitimately prefer. That's a really important benefit, I think, to diversifying the kinds of arguments you can go for on the negative especially. But also, you know, if you read a K affirmative, if there's a version of that affirmative that you can read that is a little more amenable to people that aren't necessarily huge fans of K's, then that expands the number of good judges that you have access to. So kind of think about if you're sitting down and filling out a pref sheet and you keep thinking of hypotheticals like, you know, I wouldn't want this judge against this team because I suck at answering the K, or I don't want this judge in front of this team because my strategy against their AF is the K. The problem is more you than it is the judges. So, I mean, obviously you have to do the best you can given the arguments you have when you're filling out the pref sheet, but part of the problem that people have with filling out pref sheets, I think, is really a problem with arguments and flexibility or diversity of what they can go for. So the more arguments you can go for, the more comfortable you are with different styles of arguments, the less you have to rely on kind of, you know, getting rid of some good judges that are ideologically opposed to you and instead kind of taking a risk with some judges that are younger or less experienced or less, you know, less, not necessarily competent, but, you know, judges that you really wouldn't want but that might be ideologically supportive of your style. So diversify your style, and then the question of who to strike and who to prefer is less important than it is for teams that are very limited in what they can go for.
Fair enough. Scott, what are the other questions that were asked there?
All right. Another question was asked is politics or economy / trade-off the better net benefit to the state's counterplan?
Politics.
Yep.
Jenny Hyde actually gives a good speech at camp about why economy dis-eds aren't really net benefits to the state's counterplan, and I generally agree with her that, you know, especially the way some people go for the economy dis-ed, that the economy dis-ed doesn't make sense as a net benefit with regards to the states. And I don't think that neither the AF or the NEG are good at explaining why it is or why it isn't, but I think that a good AF team can sort of be pretty solid on it's not a net benefit. I would definitely think that military trade-off.
Wait. What's the warrant for econ not a net benefit?
Well, it depends on the argument. If it's like an inflation-based dis-ed or something like that, that the effects of the spending could be, the effects of the spending on the state level could have the same inflationary effect, et cetera. It's not, I mean, if it's a budget argument, it's probably, you know, more of a net benefit, but a lot of the arguments are kind of like, if the state, you know, what is the difference between the counterplan and the plan in a world where the counterplan spends money and the plan does? So the net benefit needs to be directly tied to like federal budget or something like that. But
you know, what DA is not tied to federal budget?
No, but I'm saying like spending.
Like a wage inflation dis-ed or a.
Oh yeah, well that's like solvency.
That's a different thing. Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, I think that makes some spending dis-eds, you know, go down, especially go down in value. And I mean, can anyone win like a just general spending economy DA now? I mean,
it's tough to. I think people, if you want to rehabilitate the fiscal discipline dis-ed, you have to. You can't really win that more spending
in a time machine
the economy. You need to frame it almost like a more like a K that fiscal. Irresponsibility is bad because it results in long-term economic disaster or whatever. But it's hard. I don't think that you can really viably win a short-term economic collapse from the additional spending of the plan. So, yeah, the fiscal discipline dis-ed is not in good shape and hasn't been for a while.
No, I got to disagree here. I think the fiscal discipline DA is like the sacred cow DA is like probably the easiest DA in the world to spend maybe 2 hours updating some uniqueness and putting together like 3 or 4 tricky link arguments for the 2NC.
Like what? What uniqueness? What link?
Well, uniqueness is generally some kind of trick about like predictive evidence for why spending will decline. So even though they're spending now, or some kind of uniqueness.
We're about to pass a healthcare bill.
A revenue neutral healthcare bill.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. That's what you
I'm sure, Roy, you probably don't think Obama was born in the country, so your opinion on the healthcare bill. Seriously, if you can name 3 provisions of the healthcare bill, I'll admit that you're correct on this.
Well, there's the restrictions on abortions. I've read up on that due to our...
Okay, that's one.
Due to our affirmative, there's the low-cost public option.
Is that the revenue-neutral one? Right. Okay, that proves your point. What's your third provision?
I don't know.
Okay.
Something with insurers, I'm sure.
I rest my case. Okay. So, but I think it's just one of those arguments.
It's enough to note the Cato Foundation says it's not.
The level of economic knowledge of the general populace is so low that I think you can just steamroll people on the spending DA with very little investment and a small amount of economics knowledge. Now, granted, it's much like the politics that said that it's total garbage, but I don't know why people are just like, oh, yeah, politics, total garbage, winnable, can win every debate on it. But then they're like, oh, the spending disad, there's no uniqueness for that. It's like they're both equally stupid. I don't understand what you think the difference is.
Well, I think for me, the problem isn't uniqueness. It's the relationship between the uniqueness and the internally to the impact. So
you think it's much more likely that passing food stamps would derail health care than it is it would hurt the budget?
You think there's more direct impact that health care will have an effect on the economy?
Right.
That's the internal link. One derails the one economy, the other derails the agenda.
It's not a question of the derailment part, all right?
It's the magnitude of the impact. So,
I get what you're saying. Okay. What I'm saying is that it's equally unlikely that the plan will affect healthcare will affect
the
economy.
That's not the issue he's talking about.
No, I understand what Scott's saying. He's just saying that a part of the politics DA is equally stupid.
Yes,
I think the difference is that the impact is more important for the negative because of the offense-defense paradigm. So in most cases, the strength of the link is secondary to the strength of the impact, the way that most DA debates get resolved, which I don't necessarily agree with. I obviously don't agree with that. But so if you have the problem with the fiscal discipline disad is that you're stronger on the link, you're weak on the internal link to the impact, whereas on the politics disad, you're weak on the link, but your impact, theoretically, you're strong on. And so, you know, we have a big impact, DA turns the case, blah, 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 we control uniqueness, whatever, makes it easier to execute that dissent in front of most judges, I think, than the spending dissent.
I don't understand why that logically makes sense, that one internal link results in less DA than the other internal link. It's a chain of events.
I'm not agreeing with the way that that would be resolved, but that's, I think that is the way that dissents get resolved. It's like, first thing we look at is impact. Second thing we look at is uniqueness. Third thing we look at is link. And so, you know, like the bulk of the 2NRs on a DA are like, we control uniqueness. 1% risk of the link means we win this giant impact, which outweighs in terms of the case. And the spending DA is weakest on the DA outweighs in terms of the case part and stronger on the link part. So strategically,
because you don't think the economy is a good impact?
To spending, right, to fiscal discipline. Because even if you can win uniqueness that fiscal discipline will be improved in the status quo, or that, you know, spending will be balanced or the budget will be balanced, the internal link argument that fiscal irresponsibility collapses the economy is empirically denied, and it's very difficult to win a threshold to that impact.
Wow, I got to disagree with that. I think the cards that make a connection between the budget and the economy are much better than the cards about like healthcare and the economy.
Well, I guess, but I mean, if you like,
don't agree with him, Bill. You're right. Don't agree.
If you read I subscribe to the Cato Institute and Heritage Foundation and all of those, and the fiscal discipline cards are very good, but they're also like each of the impact cards also is a non-unique card. So it's like there is massive spending in the status quo, and that's horrible. That's why I think I was only sort of joking about the critique-y style impact, but it's like it's hard to win a Brink-based dissad when your impact authors are critical of how much we're spending in the status quo. So it's hard to differentiate between the minor amount of spending that the plan increases over the status quo versus the massive amount of spending that the impact authors are already criticizing.
Sacred cow link.
Whatever.
I guess. I don't even really know what that means.
It's just a snowball. It's a link magnifier.
Well, right, but it seems like if you're reading like a, you know, Heritage Foundation deficit's bad card, it will begin with, you know, entitlement spending is out of control. By 2050, it will be, you know, greater than the GDP. You know, it's hard to distinguish between the other types of spending that they are critical of and the spending of the plan. It's not like the, passing an off-budget sacred cow policy would change how much Medicare costs or how much Medicaid costs. And those are really the crucial internal links to the deficit, I think.
I agree. Scott disagrees. Scott, disagree?
I mean, I do, but there's no reason to rehash sure, everything we just said.
I agree.
I just think in order to win the spending set, if you're thinking about going for the fiscalist 1DA, you need to answer, you need to have some way to answer the entitlement spending. Whether, I mean, maybe that's a counterplan to, you know, do entitlement reform or something, or it has to be some meaningless argument that can explain why your link is more important than entitlement spending. And if you can do that, then I agree with Scott that the spending DA is viable, but I just think that's very hard, and I haven't heard someone do that yet.
Strong. That's a strong conclusion to this podcast, I think.
Is that the conclusion, Roy? You got to go to watch Top Chef?
I mean, are there more questions here?
There are.
Let's hear him. One more. Pick one more good one.
Let's quickly go through the end.
All right. Last one then. It says, racism and patriarchy advantages. How would teams that claim these advantages solve for big impacts like Warren and Katie when they probably don't solve for all patriarchy?
They don't solve for all patriarchy. You figured it out. They don't. It's a lie. The economy dissent is better than the racism and patriarchy advantage.
Roy, that sounded very racist and patriarchal.
It's not racist and patriarchal. It's true. You don't solve for all of patriarchy. You probably don't even solve for the issue that you claim that you think that you solve for, let alone all of the patriarchal system. All right? It is one instance of stopping something. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 did not end all discrimination, even though it ended patriarchy. If you allowed, you know, repealed some provision of the... Whatever.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964.
I was moving on in my head. I mean, Padma's on Top Chef right now, and I got a little distracted. I'm not going to lie. And she's in the bathroom. But the point is that one instance of legislation did not stop all of discrimination then. The plane would not be able to resolve all of the discrimination in the future. You know, it's just one policy. It doesn't set up, you know, it maybe you could make like a mindset argument, like, you know, it helps change people's minds, but I don't think that on balance these things, you know, they help, but they don't solve for the system, you know, all of the system's inequalities.
Well, I guess if maybe Batterman, you want to elaborate on this, how would you set that up as a debate argument though? You probably wouldn't want to give the just like rambling stream of incoherent gibberish that Roy said. So what would you think would be an effective way to phrase this argument, Batterman?
I think, the first thing is don't read consequentialism good cards. That's what I've seen a million times in the 1NC. The 1AC is like the TANF affirmative that ends marriage promotion in TANF and then says that marriage promotion causes patriarchy and patriarchy is bad, and the 1NC will say, consequences are important. Policymakers should consider consequences. That is not a response. You need to make intelligent alternate causality arguments. So you need to ideally have some evidence that explains either that other programs, like if you're debating the patriarchy affirmative, other current government policies are patriarchal, or even better, that they rely on the same internal link to patriarchy that the affirmative does. So maybe there's marriage promotion in something other than TANF, which there is. Say that the affirmative therefore does not solve their internal link to patriarchy. And then secondly, you need to make kind of inevitability / uniqueness arguments against the impact, even if it's true that patriarchy is responsible for certain violent consequences. The degree to which the affirmative is able to resolve patriarchy or to decrease patriarchy is not necessarily the degree required to end all violence or to end all poverty or whatever the impact says. So, like, if you're debating the Warren and Katie argument, kind of a, you know, patriarchy inevitable, there is a threshold required for solvency in order to solve the impact. The affirmative does not cross that threshold. That's something you can cross-ex about. And then just, I think it's important to just, you know, debate the truth value of their internal link. So if you're debating the TANF affirmative, you know, have a reason that marriage promotion maybe isn't patriarchal, or if it is patriarchal, it's not patriarchal in the way that would culminate in global violence. Or if you're debating a racism affirmative, maybe the current policy is not racist in the way that would culminate in genocidal wars or whatever. Just kind of contest that. Too often teams just spot the whole internal link chain and then just debate the impact, and they're like, well, there will always be racism and consequences that way or whatever. So if you contest the internal link a little bit more, focus more on that instead of just the terminal impact, I think you're in better shape. And don't just say consequences good. If you have an economy impact or whatever, you can say, risks that culminate in death are more important than risks that culminate in racism or discrimination. That's fine, but just the idea that policymakers should evaluate consequences is not responsive to an affirmative that says that racism is bad or patriarchy is bad.
There's not one thing that is the root cause of all wars.
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, just like some quick Google searches, if you type in, like, monocausal and violence, you can find a lot of people who critique the idea that there's a root cause of all kind of like wars and conflicts. But then I think to tie this into kind of Roy's cross-ex thing, I think this is a good example of issues that you can ask in cross-examination. And I think it's a perfect 1-2 punch setup, because if you just come up with some obscure violent historical event, let's say you ask the AF, how is patriarchy the root cause of the Bay of Pigs or something? either they're going to admit, oh, well, there's mitigating factors. We're just saying a world of patriarchy makes violence more likely, not that it's the actual proximate cause of all global violence, at which point you've already won your impact takeout. Or they're going to say something stupid, and they're going to say, well, it's the realist containment logic that views anarchy as feminine and threatening that causes blah, blah, blah. And then you just be like, how do you solve that? Like, why does eliminating marriage promotion change that belief in policymakers' minds? And then they're like, and it's like, okay, ball game. So mm-hmm. I think that's just like, if you ask some intelligent questions about these kind of things, it makes it a lot easier then in your speech to just kind of blow it off with like the thumbs down.
Yeah, that's definitely what I feel about this.
Yeah, the other cross-ex strategy that I think is useful is kind of ask questions like you're criticizing or questioning their impact. How does patriarchy cause war? How does patriarchy cause poverty or whatever their impact is? How does it lead to the destruction of the environment? And then once they've explained kind of the totalizing awfulness of patriarchy or racism or whatever their impact is, then ask questions about the ability of the AF to solve. So if the underlying logic of patriarchy destroys the environment because it mobilizes massive, government organizations in resource conquests that neglect the environment, or it sets up a system of domination or whatever, it's like, well, how does the affirmative resolve all of those other things? So the kind of asking questions about one issue and then following up with questions about what you're really getting at can be effective. But, yeah, I think the historical example method of cross-exing is really good. You could do that. I've seen people do that with capitalism, like, why was X conflict caused by capitalism? And usually the negative team will, explain something absurd, and then they just look stupid. So that – definitely, this is a good example of the cross-ex stuff that we already talked about before.
I just wonder why you read that internal link to get to that impact. Like, if you're going to read a patriarchy or racism impact, just embrace the fact that this isn't the root cause of all wars, but that they're neither of which are good things. Patriarchy is not a good thing. It causes suffering, oppression. It's got some bad impacts. Racism, not a good thing. It discriminates. It hurts. It's bad. It's going for those impacts. Like, I think that it might even be strategic for an AF, if you're going to read those impacts, to try to get the negative to focus on the root cause of war impact, like not root cause, and then they kind of spot you the more systemic short-term true impact rather than, and they only deal with the big, big picture impact.
Yeah, like, I think that's really good advice. I actually told St. Mark's that at Nutrier, almost identical to what you just said, because the all these marriage promotions.
That's a sign, Bill.
I know. I was a little concerned there, but all these marriage promotion affirmatives have really good evidence that marriage promotion causes domestic violence, and they have because essentially, if you get more money for being married, then if you're in a abusive relationship, you'll stay in it because you get more money from welfare, and that seems like an impact to me and an important impact. And if the negative doesn't answer it at all, it seems like you should focus on that instead of the kind of this sort of silly idea that if we stop marriage promotion, there would be no more war in Iraq and Afghanistan because those are patriarchal wars or whatever. That just seems silly. And I have yet to ever see any team debating the marriage promotion affirmative, which I've judged a bunch, or some of these racism affirmatives actually contest the smaller scale impact. So, like, if you spot them, domestic violence / rape advantage, the affirmative should talk about that and say why that's an impact instead of just being like, whatever, irrelevant, we solve all wars. I don't understand that, the way that people, have come to that conclusion that that's a better strategy.
Yeah. All right.
I think it's a wrap.
Is that a wrap?
This is a seriously long podcast here. We're looking at like.
I'm going to go and edit out all the parts where you talk, Roy, so it'll get shorter.
Perfect.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to the 3NR podcast. This has been Scott Phillips along with
Bill Batterman and
Roy Lefkowitz. And remember, get your 3NR logos in because we're too lazy to make one ourselves.